Good morning and welcome to Cosmic Influence. My name is Walter Cruttenden and I'm here with co-host Jeff Pitino.
Good morning.
And Jeff and I work at the Binary Research Institute in Newport Beach, California, which is a little rainy outside today, but otherwise a beautiful place. And as most of our listeners know, we are focusing on ancient cultures and what they knew and is there a cycle? Were there really ancient cultures that knew a lot more pre-Dark Age than we do now? And as part of this question, we interview various speakers on different topics and get a little insight into this whole question. And today we have a very fascinating speaker. I think we've all heard of this idea of sacred geometry, but probably few of us know what that really means. And so I'd like Jeff to give a little background on our guest speaker today, Michael S. Schneider.
Sure. Well, Michael S. Schneider is an educator. He's been an educator for 34 years and still enjoys exploring the intersections of nature, science, mathematics, and art. He writes, consults, and holds workshops for adults and children, educators, artists, architects, designers, and other creative people interested in understanding nature's timeless mathematical language. Michael has a bachelor's degree of science in mathematics from the Polytechnic Institute of Brooklyn and a master's degree in mathematics education from the University of Florida in Gainesville. He's also the author of a fascinating book, The Beginner's Guide to Constructing the Universe, Mathematical Archetypes of Nature, Art, and Science, and five Constructing the Universe activity books, as well as a number of articles on mathematics in nature, art, and science. He lives in Marin County, California, and is an adjunct professor at the California College of the Arts in San Francisco, teaching mathematical ideas useful to art students.
And I've met Michael. We've chatted over the years, and he's one of the smartest guys in this field I've ever met. So with that intro, Michael, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
Good. Can you live up to that?
Well, that's quite a build-up, but I'll do what I can.
Okay. Maybe you can start us off just telling us, in layman's terms, what is sacred geometry? We've all heard the concept, but...
Well, you know, there's no set definition for that. I personally would say that it's geometry used in a sacred context. In other words, a triangle is just a triangle, but when it's used in the design of a cathedral or a temple or a work of art, I would say it's in a sacred context and used with the symbolism that comes along with that shape and so forth.
Okay. And how about your own background here? How'd you come to study mathematics? Where's that interest come from?
Well, that's a good question. To tell you the truth, I was not a really great mathematics student in my youth. But when I was 16, I got very, very interested, just it sort of caught fire, that there is a geometry throughout nature. And it's a very consistent geometry. When you see spirals, for example, there's a meaning to it in nature. Nature has purposes for these. For example, a spiral indicates dynamic balance during motion. And so we see it in whirlpools and solar systems and galaxies and embryos and so forth.
Right, everything.
Really, well, the spiral is the most widespread shape through the universe. And I wondered why this happened. And I got interested in the geometric forms of nature, and it led me more into the mathematics of it. And I realized that I'd better get a good handle on the mathematics so that I couldn't be intimidated by any mathematical idea, so I got a couple of degrees in mathematics so I could understand it better and know what I was looking at.
Well, I guess some of the very early mathematicians, early in terms of Western history, the Greeks were, wrote a lot about this subject, geometric forms, and perhaps we can... touch on that subject as soon as we come back from our short break here.
Sure.
We're listening to Cosmic Influence, and we'll be right back.
And welcome back to Cosmic Influence. I'm Jeff Pitino with our host, Walter Cruttenden, and our guest today is Michael S. Schneider. Michael, just before the break, Walter had started mentioning the historical context for sacred geometry. Can you speak to that a little bit in terms of maybe the the ancient Greeks and Egyptians?
Well, sure. Modern science, mathematics, and so forth claims to be based on knowledge that stemmed from Greece. And in great part, that's true. There were fantastic geometers from Greece, not the least of which, of course, Pythagoras, and many, many, many others. But when you look to them, they will tell us that they learned everything they know from ancient Egypt. In fact, there were no freestanding statues in Greece until they learned from Egypt. Pythagoras was a famous student of the Egyptian temple system, which included a knowledge of nature and geometry and the arts. It was all integrated. And so we can look to Greece, but Greece really got it from Egypt. And it really is clear when you look at the geometry that occurred way back. As far as we can look, you know, I have found very, very clear geometric knowledge, very intelligent and wisely used geometry in the very, very earliest Egyptian times, even pre-dynastic. They seem to have gotten the knowledge, however they came to it, completely full-blown and at the very beginning. There doesn't seem to be a build-up exploratory discovery time. They just seem to know everything at the very beginning.
That's exactly what John West and Bovall and Hancock, these guys keep telling us, too. It's just amazing how pristine this culture starts out.
Complete. And they're wonderful, wonderful, intelligent geometers. I've learned a great deal from them. I feel like I sit with the masters when I look at works of art, crafts, architecture, and design from, you know, Egypt, Greece, Babylon, China, India, Africa, Native America, all over. There seems to have been a great deal of knowledge very early on. My main interest has been the Egyptians, though. To me, they're the best. I haven't seen any geometry as sophisticated as the Egyptians used from the earliest times, pre-dynastic, and the early dynasties as well.
And can you give us a couple of examples?
Well, for example, I'm very interested in the stela, the so-called slabs of stone that have writing and pictures on them that were associated with temples. People would, you know, tombs. They'd put images of the deceased receiving offerings, and there'd be writing above it and below it and so forth. And the more I looked at these and their published dimensions, I came to realize how precise they were in the earliest days, real precision that seems to have gotten lost and degraded over the centuries.
Precise in terms of their proportions? Is this what you mean? Or?
Yes, very, very precise. In modern lingo, we'd say to quite a number of decimal places.
Okay, so what's the typical proportion there then?
Well, the one that I find most used is the golden ratio. The golden proportion. It is so clear and so widely used and very, very in specific contexts, though. I was looking for quite a while at this, and I realized how often they're using the golden ratio, which is found in the so-called golden rectangle. It's found in the five-pointed star, the pentagram, which happened to be one of the symbols, the main symbols of the Pythagorean school. And I realized how much they were using this, and I realized that they were using it whenever there was a context that involved what the Egyptians called the duat, underworld. And it occurred to me, it struck me that the hieroglyph for the duat is a five-pointed star in a circle. And I realized that I could just take that five-pointed star in a circle and a square around it, and overlay it on a great deal of art and architecture, and it would explain the proportions in great detail. In other words, they were using the symbolism of the glyph, the mathematics held in the glyph itself, to design works that related to the duat. It's quite fascinating, really.
And why did they do this? I mean, Engineers, designers nowadays rarely consider some of these basic elements. Why do you think it was important to these earlier cultures?
Well, in general, the use of geometry was considered a language in itself and not a human language. Mathematics in general is not an invention. We invent the symbols to portray mathematics, you know, the numerals, the Roman numerals, Hindu numerals, and so forth. But mathematics itself is a discovery, not created by anybody. And so all over the world, really, and at all times, geometry was used as a divine language to speak about divine and sacred subjects. Now, the golden ratio in particular occurs in the human body, the ideal human body as portrayed by the Greeks in their wonderful sculpture, shows the golden ratio throughout the body. I mean, we start off as a spiral, which is a golden ratio construct. And so it perhaps has to do with their idea of the body as a microcosm. Also, the golden ratio is unique. It's quite an interesting ratio in that it's self-reflexive. In other words, it always creates, when you divide it, it always creates subdivisions of itself. The golden ratio as a golden rectangle, let's say, which you can see, by the way, in your forearm, from your elbow to your wrist, if that's one side of a rectangle, the hand as the shorter side of a rectangle, we have a half of a golden rectangle just in our cubit. And so golden ratio rectangles can be divided into other golden rectangles and squares. And squares can be divided into squares and golden rectangles. So it's a self-reflective mathematics. And so I imagine it has something to do with the symbolism of self, of wholeness, of completeness. You know, it's hard to really read their minds as to the symbolism. But symbolism is very, very crucial to their designs.
Right. In any event, they were apparently trying to convey something that we have forgotten, or at least we don't think it's as important nowadays. You know, it reminds me of the Vedic culture, too, this whole idea of mandalas. They're meant to convey, you know, a soothing feeling to the mind, and or help one think better or see things more clearly. At least that's what I've read.
Mm-hmm. And the word mandala, mandala, literally means mind container. Manda, like, relates to our word mental, mind, and the la means container. So mind container is an interesting way to look at it. Sure, for going deep, self-realization, and different geometries, whether it's golden ratio or any of the polygons, the pentagon, the square, hexagon, triangle, and so forth, the seven-sided, all convey a different feel to them. And so they use the geometry that it was appropriate for what they're conveying. They're very, very specific about it. They're very clear that they're using a language. And it really needs to be discovered and investigated more deeply to discover what they're saying. But it's very clear that they're very specific about it. There's no accidental use of geometry.
Yeah, I know. It's just too prolific throughout the ancient world to be an accident.
Yeah, and it's very consistent around the world. I mean, cultures that had no contact with each other will use the same geometry for similar ideas. For example, the number seven. Nobody has to be told by anyone else. It just involves investigation. For example, in the first 12 numbers, 7 doesn't relate to any of them, except number 1, which relates to everything. And so it's unique, and it was considered the virgin number, because it doesn't interplay as 2 does with 4 and 3 with 6 and 5 with 10 and so forth. And so whenever there's a case of involving a virgin, a maiden, something untouchable, you'll find the number seven used. And that's all over the world. Everybody got the same significance out of it by just investigating the numbers and the ways they relate to each other. They're the greatest teacher. One can learn a great deal just from looking at numbers, and can be discovered in any time. It's not available only in certain times. Anybody can look at it, but it takes a little bit of a different kind of mindset than we have today to understand some of this symbolic language, which is universal, because mathematics is.
Right, and I think this is something you were speaking to in your book, The Beginner's Guide to Constructing the Universe, The Mathematical Archetypes of Nature, Art, and Science.
That's right. Each of the 10 chapters in the book looks at each of the first 10 numbers, 1 through 10. And so chapter 3 is about the number 3 and triangles and the appearance of the number 3 in mythology and fairy tales and folk wisdom and nature and art and symbolism and so forth, and go through all the numbers like that.
What steps did you take in researching the numbers or building your research to find the spiritual qualities for each of the different numbers?
Well, I read everything I can written by ancient writers, to see what they had to say. I also looked at nature to see what nature has to say, and I looked at art, crafts, architecture, and design to see how they were used. And over time, when you immerse yourself in this, you really get a sense of the unique qualities of each of the numbers and see how they're portrayed. So it was just a matter of research and a sort of a sensitivity to the essence of the number.
I took a class once on numerology, years and years ago, and was really impressed with the natural symbols that just fall out of numbers. And, of course, that's one thing I noticed in your book, too. Obviously one is a single point, and then two, and then three, the triangle, and four, the square, et cetera. It's a language that, as you say, is intuitive and doesn't need a whole lot of explanation.
Well, my feeling, if something is true, we already have a knowledge of it inside of ourselves. Because the numbers are archetypes, and we've got these archetypes within ourselves, and we can, feel them, feel our way through them. Now, a lot of people come to me and try to talk about numerology, and there are so many definitions for that. And I tell them, look, I look at nature as the source of numerology. I'm not one to look at numbers of birth dates and names and so forth. I look at the way that nature teaches. Nature's the greatest numerologist, if we want to say that.
I would agree. It seems to, there's a natural science that falls out from that versus the explanation of what numbers mean in one's life tends to get a little subjective.
It gets really subjective. That's why I stay with nature's teaching about it. And even better, I started looking towards nature to learn, and then I realized that nature is looking towards number itself. Because what we see in nature are really expressions of numbers and number ideas made visible and active.
Okay,
so
well,
I just look to what mathematics teaches and what nature teaches from that.
Hold that thought. You're listening to Cosmic Influence. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to Cosmic Influence. I'm Jeff Pitino with our host Walter Crutenden, and our guest today is Michael S. Schneider. Michael, I'd like to talk a little more about some of the specific qualities that a lot of these cultures held for the different numbers. I know you had mentioned the number 7 representing virginity to a number of cultures. I know in Christian theology as well, the number 7 holds a very special place in being a very holy number that recurs several times in the Bible. What are some of its other qualities, and what are some of the more unique qualities of some of the other numbers?
Well, in terms of 7, there's so much to say. Aside being virgin, it also would relate to what might be called spirit. which is really, you know, untouchable in a sense, in that it's indestructible, so it's virgin, it can't be touched. You know, the number seven will appear wherever you find something, will appear in nature, for example, wherever you find something that can't be physically grasped. In other words, there are no seven-sided objects, crystals, and so forth, like you'd find with six and other numbers. Seven involves that which you can't, like a, as a virgin, one cannot grab or hold or pin down, so to speak. So we find it in the colors of the rainbow, the seven colors. You can't grab them. Or in the seven notes of the musical scale. They're there, and then they're not there. Or as our friend, the great writer, philosopher John Michel has said, no one has ever had to sweep up after listening to music. You know, it's just not there. It's not graspable. The there are seven crystal systems. Now, we can grasp the crystals, but we can't grasp the idea. We can't grasp the system. It's an idea. And so it relates that way. And also, of course, a great part of the symbolism of the number seven, which I think is the predominant number in the Bible. If you look at a concordance, you'll find pages and pages and pages of reference to seven. The so-called, what we call the chakra, the seven chakras of the subtle body are seven, traditionally seven. And so this is something we don't physically grasp, but we can feel. Everybody knows what it feels when you feel love in the heart or fear in the gut and so forth.
Right. Or as you mentioned, it's so easy to attach a geometric symbol to each number, a point for one, a line for two, a triangle for three, a square for four, a pentagon or star for five, the sort of the center number, and then you double the three for six. You have a problem with seven, whereas you can double four for eight and triple three, you know, three triangles for nine. But you're right. Seven just doesn't come up easily in the mind.
No, not only that, but seven is one of the numbers, or the seventh side of the heptagon, cannot be perfectly constructed with a compass and straight edge,
as you
can do with a pentagon or hexagon. It's ungraspable. You can't construct it, even. So the lesson is very consistent about that number and all the numbers, really.
Yeah, you know, I wish they would have taught us this in school. And in school, you just learn the numbers by rote starting off, and geometry came, you know, much later, and then it was more rules than really putting the symbols together with the numbers.
Right. I wish I'd learned this, too. In fact, it's a very common statement I hear from people. Gee, I wish I read your book, and I wish this was taught in school. I wish I learned this when I was a child. Mathematics education is a really big disappointment, because it would go so much further with children if mathematics was related to nature and art. It goes very, very far with nature, but instead it's really a utilitarian thing. It's for, you know, calculating taxes and sales tax and measuring bookcases and so forth. Oh, it would go a long way in the world if we had a educational system that valued this. But there is no value understood for it. You know, what good is the symbolism? What good is, you know, understanding it as we see it around us? You need to know how to calculate and add and subtract and those are all very useful, but it's not all there is.
Good.
In fact, I get a lot of email and comments from teachers around the world who are using my beginner's guidebook and also the five workbooks to teach even young children. Some children really get into it. It's like I won't say they're old souls necessarily, but something happens and they catch on to it and they just catch fire with it as I did when I was 16. So it's a very, very good way to get children involved in appreciating mathematics, because most of us get turned off to it. As you said, the geometry education, I never would have had a clue as to what geometry could be about. In my education, I think it was the 10th grade, geometry was about memorization, proofs and theorems and axioms and lemmas. You know, given angle A equals angle B, prove that side A equals side B, you know, step one, assume the blah, blah, blah. And there is a good value for that in sharpening the mind, but it's not all there is.
Good. Well, I'm glad you're teaching what you're teaching, because I believe it leads to just a more holistic way to look at the universe.
That is correct.
Yeah, very much so. In fact, I know when you talk about number five in the book, you relate it to the Pentagon, as you mentioned a couple minutes ago, and that that actually in itself underlies a number of growth patterns in nature, from plants to the human skeletal structure. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, number five, lovely, lovely number. There's so much to say. Let's say, well, it appears, I like to start with where it appears in nature. You can look at five-petaled flowers, which is the predominant number of petals and flowers, the five arms of the starfish, and the five fingers of the hands, the five obvious senses, five all over the place. So when we look at that, we can get a little more insight if we realize, for example, that the starfish regenerates. In other words, if an arm is pulled off, or, you know, by an animal or something, and a little piece, at least a little piece of the central nervous system of the starfish, we can really see as a circle of bumps around it. If a little piece of the central nervous system is incorporated in that arm, not only would the arm grow a whole new body, but the body will also grow a new arm. And the idea is here is regeneration. Then we can look deeper into the mathematics and realize that that's exactly what the five-pointed star does. It regenerates mathematically. In other words, it reproduces itself in miniature all over the place. And so the lesson of the geometry of regeneration appears in nature as organic regeneration.
Well, we need to regenerate ourselves here for just a moment. You're listening to Cosmic Influence. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. You know, Michael, in all the study of ancient cultures we've done, we find that tombs, cairns, henges, dolmens, things constructed prior to about 1500 BC seem to always be aligned with equinoxes or solstices, or they take into account sort of the bigger world around us when they're constructed. And it's not that way so much today. You know, this modern planning just seems to not take into account the universe around us. And I'm wondering if there's a very practical benefit to understanding, you know, how the universe is constructed and sacred structures to make a better world today. Your thoughts on that?
I'd have to agree with you. The modern world is clearly fragmented, not just in different peoples and different ideas, but the notion of the universe is no longer universe. Everything's fragmented, and it's reflected not only in our thinking, but in the ways we go about building things and create societal institutions. Whereas in ancient times, around the world, a major idea was the idea of holism, holistic, complete, integrated wholeness, interrelated wholeness. And so this is what you'll find in any culture, let's say ancient China, brilliant, brilliant people. While the Europeans were in the so-called Dark Age, China was in a Golden Age. Same with India.
Well, at least less of a dark age. The Han Dynasty wasn't too nice.
Oh, yeah, well, okay.
But they didn't lose as much knowledge on the way down, that's for sure.
No, they kept getting back to it. And you can see it in their art and crafts. But the idea of holistic was very important. So all the symbolism was integrated, color, music, dance, all the arts, crafts, architecture, philosophy, complete integration. One of the things that struck me, I lived in New York City for many years, and I spent I don't know how many hours in the Egyptian wing of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Great, great collection. Many, many hours. In fact, I even was able to give walking tours through it eventually. And in looking at everything, I realized that nothing was designed, nothing was made without conscious design to it, harmonious design, so that even the most ordinary objects, you know, brooms and chairs and other furniture and, you know, little bottles and plates and everything we see around us today, everything was very intentionally designed to convey harmony. And the philosophy was that if you're exposed to harmony everywhere in your life, you'll have a taste for it, and you'll want it and demand it, and you will be able to more easily find that harmony and centeredness within ourselves. So everything, even people who, the ordinary people who didn't understand these ideas that were coming out of temples, were exposed to visual, auditory harmony in every way, so that the society would be able to be seen as a harmony and had better chance for progress, as opposed to today, where there's no consideration of that. Although you can find the use of the golden ratio, for example, or other proportions of very much in use, but for very, very different reasons. For example, an ordinary credit card is just a hair, just seriously a hair away from a perfect golden rectangle. And I think that slight difference is so it can slide into the machine without getting caught. So we'll find these proportions in, you know, the design of packages of cigarettes and food and television sets and you name it, but it's not for the same reasons. It's not for conveying harmony to the society. It's more like, oh, this is a pleasant-looking little thing. I guess I'll use it more, referring to credit cards, perhaps.
I can imagine how that would definitely be a goal of a credit card company.
Oh, well, you might be surprised at how much it's used in advertising. Proportions, colors, rhythms of timing. I can see these proportions in use, but they're obviously not for the same reasons. They're more for, you see, these proportions reach down deep into us, and advertising knows that's where they want to get. So when they bombard us with these proportions and timings and so forth, and sound intervals, it's not for really for our own good. It's more of it seems like a selfish reason to get us interested and to feel good about purchasing whatever it is, you see.
Right. Well, you know, we've come a long way from the golden age through the dark age, but I think just the fact that we're becoming aware of some of these things again is tipping us in the right direction again. I
think so. I think it awakens something deep and latent within us that really needs to be awakened again, if only for our own benefit. And to dissolve this feeling of fragmentation that pervades everything.
Yeah, and I actually find it really interesting, the idea that there are certain proportions and ratios that seeing them visually actually does somehow affect us deep down psychologically and provide a sense of oneness and comfort and harmony.
Yeah, well, it's all over. I mean, you know, everything in nature has a shape, and that shape tells us something. And if we understand what the shape is about, we understand what nature is doing there.
Good. Well, I see a trend, you know, back towards a more green mode of living, and I think that as that trend picks up speed, it will encompass, you know, not just better use of energy, but better use of, you know, shapes and colors and sounds, a whole more holistic aesthetic movement there.
Well, I hope so. I sincerely hope so, although there's a sort of a battle between those who want to use it for those purposes of spiritual and psychological uplift versus those who want to use it to manipulate us for whatever ends, to purchase something or to believe something.
Yeah.
But I believe that the good will win out.
Hopefully it will. And you're listening to Cosmic Influence, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. Michael, I know you actually teach elements of sacred geometry in art today. What are some of the ways that you teach your students to apply it, and what are some of the ways that it is applied in art today?
Yeah, give us a flavor of a typical class.
Well, flavor of a class. Well, first of all, I don't teach it as sacred geometry. I teach it really as a traditional proportioning and symmetry. I don't bring any kind of sacred or religious, I shouldn't say I don't bring religious, I mean I point out how these have been used in different religions. But I essentially give my students a traditional course in proportion and geometry, and it gives them the tools to be able to look at works of art, crafts, architecture, design, so that they can apply it. A typical class will start off with, they'll have prepared by some reading, and then I will have something of a Socratic approach where I'll question them, they'll answer, and we'll have a conversation. Then I show examples of typical, proportioning particular number in nature, where it appears throughout nature, so we can learn to identify it. And then in culture, in fairy tales, there are three wishes, three sisters, three witches, three attempts, three brothers, three, you name it. And we'll look at it that way, how it appears in culture. And then we'll look and see how the proportions have been used in art through the centuries, whether it's from Egypt or Babylon or the Renaissance, which was very big in this, into modern times. I mean, you can find the golden rectangle, three golden rectangles stacked one on top of each other, and you've got the United Nations building in New York. So this all appears throughout many, many centuries, and we work with a compass and straight edge to do the geometric construction so they know how to do this. We learn how, what are the typical subdivisions of these and ways to use this geometry. And then for homework, I have students who have a great many different majors. They're architects and fashion designers and glass blowers and photographers and furniture designers and so many interests that I don't give them one assignment to everybody, but I say, okay, you've seen how this appears in nature, you've seen it in art, you've seen it in culture and society. Create something of your own interest. Bring something to class next week that shows me you've understood something about this. And I get the most wonderful projects coming back. I get people, they come in with, they'll make clothing that's based on pentagonal symmetry. And when you do that, when you, for example, design something, I tell them, with the golden ratio, whether it's clothing or an accessory to clothing or a tool, what happens is it's not just added onto the body, but it becomes an extension of the natural proportions that exist in the body. So it's integrated in the harmony of the body, and so we can use these and see them and wear them with more proportion and beauty and balance. And so every week it's like a Christmas present to me. I get a number of projects that are just more than I could have imagined coming through these young people's imaginations. They're like 19, 20 years old, 18, 19, 20. And their imaginations are wonderful, but they've been starved for real mathematics, and they're very appreciative. So I get to see what they're designing, beautiful, beautiful things.
That's a very positive and beneficial thing to do for the world. We should tell people where they can get your book and your website address. Can you give that to us?
Oh, sure. Well, you can get A Beginner's Guide to Constructing the Universe almost anywhere, many, many online book sites, where you can get it cheaper, as a matter of fact, than you can get it in a bookstore. It's not expensive as it is, but you can get it online for half the price that you can find it in, in Barnes & Noble. But you can get it in all the major bookstores. And the five workbooks, Constructing the Universe activity books, are only sold through my website, which is constructingtheuniverse.com.
Okay. And if someone wants to take one of your classes, how do they go about finding out where you're giving one?
Well, right now I only teach at the California College of the Arts in San Francisco and sometimes in Oakland, on the Oakland, beautiful Oakland campus. But I occasionally give public talks and workshops, and I announce them on the ConstructingTheUniverse.com website. And I do consulting for private people in the designs of things they're making or writing about, or I sometimes work with architects who want me to teach their office about some of this. So I work as either a private consultant or occasionally a public workshop presenter.
Okay. And what is your own hope, dream, that will come from this, from what you're teaching?
That's a really good question. Well, I'm hoping that whatever fever is taking over the world right now will eventually break, and that people will come to appreciate the wonder of the ordinary, the wonder of the simple, the wonder of what we really pass by and overlook all the time, and that people will come to appreciate the forms of nature. I mean, even the forms we can't see, like the invisible wind, has geometry to it. And as I said earlier, when we understand the shape that's occurring in nature, we'll understand what nature is trying to do there. And it may make us more amenable to working with nature rather than against nature or trying to change nature, but rather to go with it. And the first step is understanding the geometry, the mathematics behind it. It's also a very good doing this kind of geometry with a compass and straight edge and not a mouse on the computer. It changes a person. It actually changes us inside. Some people use geometric construction as a form of meditation. You know, you'll be working on something, and you'll look up, and you realize an hour has passed, and you're feeling very calm and centered and feeling like one has insights. And so I'm hoping that people recognize the value of personal transformation in this, and perhaps it can spread to society and people of goodwill who want to spread the message of wholeness and harmony and beauty.
Well, you say that you don't use any religious connotations in your work per se, but the feeling is that you're conveying something very beneficial and very spiritual, and we appreciate your work for that. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but Michael, thanks for being on the show. And
thank you, Walter and Jeff. It's my great pleasure.
Okay, look forward to having you back. Take care,
thanks.
Michael.
Thanks for listening to The Cosmic Influence. I'm Jeff Pitino with our host, Walter Cruttenden. Don't forget, we have the CPAC conference coming up. CPAC 2008 will be at UC San Diego in the Mandeville Center. You can register online at cpaconline.com. That's cpaconline.com. And if you'd like more information on the research we do here at BRI, you can visit the binaryresearchinstitute.org website, where you can learn all about our research and also about Lost Star of Myth and Time, the Walter's book. Once again, thanks again for listening, and bring on the higher ages.